We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday, April 22nd, 2024, as we bring you a new episode. The Chicago White Sox were swept once again. Shocker. As they hit the under on our 8.5 runs scored for the series, Mark. So kudos to Jim and I for getting that right. There were being no hit deep into the first two games of the series, and Garrett Crochet got beat up by Alec Baum. The White Sox are now 3-18. So in a way, it's pretty impressive that they're already 15 games below 500 at the 21-game mark of the season. And now they head to Minneapolis for a 4-game series. In this episode, we'll preview that series, look around what else is happening in Major League Baseball, and talk about Noah Schultz as Jim Margulis drove up to Bowling Green, Kentucky to watch the Winston-Salem Dash this weekend. But we have to talk about this embarrassing start to the season for the White Sox, a historical start for the White Sox, and quite frankly, changes in the clubhouse are needed if the White Sox get swept again by the Twins. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And I'll start here, gents. I was away this weekend. I was in St. Louis visiting friends. And watching the condensed games on Friday and Sunday, I watched the entire game on Saturday. I don't even know why I did that, but it was kind of entertaining at the end and just how the ninth inning went. There's bad baseball. There's embarrassing baseball, and there's an insult to professional baseball. And that's where the White Sox are currently at right now.
Like, you're saying there's White Sox baseball.
That's White Sox baseball. Did I expect a competitive series in Philadelphia? No. If you listen to our past podcast, Jim and I didn't think the White Sox would score more than 8.5 runs. That's not competitive baseball if you're scoring that few of runs, especially team against the Phillies. But I'm open to being surprised here. Like, I'm searching for positive things to say about this club so it doesn't kill the joy of watching the sport we love. And this White Sox team is making that task almost impossible. Like, this fast method, we're going to be better on defense. We're going to be more aggressive on the base paths. We're going to execute better. No, it continues to get worse as the season progresses, and we're barely into this season. And Jim, it's gotten so bad. Like, I think Chris Getz should be in Minneapolis for this 4-game series. And while there, if he watches his White Sox team get swept by the Minnesota Twins, Pedro Grifol has to be fired. Because clearly there is some type of disconnect in the clubhouse that he is not able to execute the game plan that Chris Getz in the front office had prior to this season. And this isn't a bunch of 23 and 24-year-olds that are playing at every position, Jim. There's a lot of veterans on this team that are not playing. They're really having the worst years of their entire careers right now. And it's just a complete disconnect and execution of what the White Sox were envisioning or attempting to do. And it really came unfold this weekend against the Phillies. And if it happens again in Minneapolis against a Twins team that's just not playing good baseball right now, you got to make a clubhouse change.
Yeah, I mean, almost, except you could say that Getz might have to do it just so people, like, don't look at him. You know, just throw somebody else under the bus because...
Get the attention away from him. Absolutely.
Because, like, this was his idea. This was, he was selling this. This wasn't like Pedro Grifol saying, like, yeah, I brought in a bunch of guys I like. This was Getz moving, rearranging the furniture around Grifol with the coaching staff. This was him bringing in players and saying, we're going defense first. We're raising the baseball IQ. I don't like our team. We need to do things a lot better. And you could see the argument for it, but you could also see the fault line underneath it just by saying, well, if you define your team around not making mistakes, what happens when they invariably make mistakes? Because they're not automatons. They will screw up. There will be pressure to make things happen. Or in the case of Jimenez, Robert, Moncada all getting hurt, like there will be injuries and guys will be forced into positions either they don't normally play or just play more playing time than they normally get or batting against pitchers they don't normally see. And so what happens when like the first string idea falls apart or suffers some dents? What then? And right now we're seeing what then is 3-18. And that was always the possibility. I mean, I predicted them to have a 54-108 record. And right now it feels optimistic. And I did just because like, you know, I kind of thought like, well, it's really hard to lose 108 games. Like that's why projection systems rarely go that south because like normally there's a floor of talent around every major league team. And you need a whole bunch of bad breaks on top of, unimpressive talent to get there on a projected level. But yeah, I looked at the roster and thought like, well, you know, if it goes wrong, it could go really wrong. So I may as well just kind of throw that number out there to capture it going really wrong because the White Sox don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. So like Getz having done this and like we talked about his offseason grade and how like I was considering an F before like he started having some future forward trades. Because he had an offseason that I could have. Like if I were GM, like I could only sign players who are desperate for a major league contract because I couldn't sell them on a vision. They would say, why is a blogger running this team? I have major league value. I'm not going to sign with them. And like, so I would get the Paul DeYoungs of the world saying like, well, you know, it's guaranteed Chris Flexen, et cetera. Like those are the contracts I could sign and I could try to spin it a certain way. But ultimately my MO would be like, I can only do so much because nobody respects me. So like when you can't tell Chris Getz's off season apart from my own, that's when I start wondering like, I question the validity of the strategy. So, you know, right now it's kind of all going south and like Grifol's a terrible salesman. Like at the very least, he should be able to have like a John McKay sensibility or Earl Weaver, like somebody who could just like rip the team in a funny fashion, get some quotes out of it, get some yucks, win some people over with some well-timed one-liners, but he can't do that. So like he can't distract or even like provide like a momentary change of mood. He just, you know, he's always about like, well, there could be a winning streak. Sure. Yeah, I guess that's theoretically possible. That's why they had a 0.02% chance of getting to the postseason versus 0.000 flat across the board. Because like theoretically, a lot of things could happen that facilitate like a big winning streak. But you're 3-18. You know, you're not going to. So if only to have a different messenger, it makes sense to fire him. But like this goes all the way to the top. And I guess, you know, they're saying that, you know, the clubhouse hasn't fallen apart, but that's because you have a lot of guys who can't afford to bail on this clubhouse because of their own careers. Like Nicky Lopez can't afford to be unprofessional. Paul DeYoung, he's been playing fine, but like Braden Shoemake can't afford to be unprofessional because like this is his best chance. It might be his last best chance. So yeah, this is the underbelly of that strategy is just like, well, if you get a bunch of guys who are happy to be there, they might be so untalented or like overmatched that like they just have to be good soldiers and you're mistaking like good chemistry for the fact that this is all they can do. This is the only face they can put on it because they have nowhere else to go.
The veterans have been awful. And James, you asked me before we started recording, pinpoint one thing and not be like buckshot out of a shotgun. and try to say everything is wrong with the White Sox, because we all know.
I was just curious.
Everything is wrong with the White Sox. But let me, I'll say this, right? Because of the way that Grifol managed last season, we know he will stick with veterans through whatever slumps and bad play they go through. Andrew Benintendi has an OPS of 371. An OPS of 371. Robbie Grossman's got an OPS of 527. A slugging percentage of 200. There is no pop in Robbie Grossman's bat. He should be allowed to swing with the metal bat. Martin Maldonado should be designated hitter. Okay, like hit four. Pitchers should bat for themselves when Martin Maldonado's in the starting lineup. They may have more competitive at-bats than Maldonado's currently having right now. And Kevin Pillar plays so sparingly, like he's clearly the fourth or fifth outfielder for the Chicago White Sox team. But all these guys were supposed to bring some type of veteran leadership. And along with that type of leadership, not just talk in the clubhouse, but playing at a major league level on the field. And none of them are doing that. Grifol's going to stick with these guys throughout this entire series to his own detriment. And I don't know if he can motivate them to get out of this slump. Like, I'm sure I can understand if Grifol behind the scenes is banging his head against every whiteboard when he's on the road. Like, I can't believe how bad these veterans are. And these veterans have been awful. And I don't know I just don't know how Grifol turns this around, which is why, like, I'm really now out, because I think with any other manager going to this Minneapolis series, you would just make an example of these particular players and just play the young guys over them. Like, I'm totally cool with benching Benintendi for the entire series against Minnesota. He's been that bad.
What's the question?
Yeah, I don't have a question for you. So we'll move over, because the White Sox are going to try something here. So Chris Getz made a move after the game against the Phillies. According to Daryl Van Scowen of the Chicago Sun-Times, Lenin Sosa is being optioned for Danny Mendick, which Mendick has been in a hitting tear down in Charlotte. We'll get to Lenin Sosa in a moment. But James, with the White, you'll be joining the White Sox in Minneapolis, so thank you to Sox Machine Patreon supporters. James will be in Minneapolis for this four-game series, covering the series for us for Sox Machine. Let's speculate here, James. With Danny Mendick joining the White Sox, do you think that he gets an extended run with the White Sox again, starting every day?
I bet that it's not that level of commitment. I would assume he'd start the first game. I think maybe 3 out of 4 of the series would be reasonable. They certainly have room to play him in multiple spots. They could start him at second. They can start him at third. He's a hot bat, and they don't really have that. And, you know, Shoemake and Lopez, expect that Pedro probably likes a little bit what he's got of Lopez out of leadoff spot last couple of days, at least making contact and stuff like that. So I would expect maybe Shoemake to be the first, like, under kind of threat of that. But he's a hot hitter. He's got good plate discipline. You know, we've definitely seen him go on runs for a period of time. He can defend his position ably enough, even if it's not like a big toolsy guy, maybe the most grit over tools guy we've seen around these parts. But as far as like a huge injection to the offense, it's just a lot of like piecemeal like solutions, because they don't have like a big weapon they could add on there. I don't think Tommy Pham more represents professional at bats, good historical plate discipline, and some pop, rather than like someone who's the expectations you normally would have given over these, probably gonna just jump in and hit between 3 and 5 once he arrives. So they don't really have this one tool that can fix the offense that's supposed to be like someone like Luis Robert or, you know, Pique Juan Moncada, whatever that is anymore, or Eloy Jimenez, you know, even at least second half of 2022, that was an impact hitter still. Those sort of solutions still need to kind of arise in-house a little bit. And we've been seeing like 20th percentile outcomes and nothing but for seemingly a year and a half now, which even if I can't pin what Grifol is doing to make that happen, a lot of correlation as a manager eventually issue equals causation if it persists as long as it has so far.
Maybe that was the question I was really trying to figure out how to ask you, but thank you for getting to that point, James. I appreciate you.
So, like, I think those early hooks that you see, manager firings, hitting coach firings, the pressure's got to come from above eventually, whether it's a GM that feels like this is a win now season and I have to pass off blame, or, you know, other reasons. And I don't necessarily see Jerry Reinsdorf, you know, he surprised me more than once over the last 6 years. But like, at least his public messaging has not been like, what the French toast? I don't understand what we're getting here. I think there's a bit of like, he publicly defended Pedro, and I don't think he's like breathing down Chris's Getz neck like, hey, you told me we'd be winning a division this season either. So I'd be surprised, but you know, this it's not a team that lacks the capacity to surprise us for zany happening. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think with Sosa going down, I think, you know, he's an easy one to pick just because there is the lack of production of the plate, but also like, he ran into Gavin Sheets. He screwed up a rundown and allowed a run to score because he was late making decisions. Like, he's kind of showing the same slow processing that he was last year. And, you know, the White Sox want to play fast. Like, that's the kind of idea, or that's kind of play that they're targeting, is you have to know where to go with the ball. And like, he's, you know, two high-profile incidents, kind of like with Oscar Colas running into Elvis Andrus or throwing to the wrong base. You know, it's those mistakes. However, like, you know, and going back to Andrew Benintendi, like, he airmailed two cutoff men, gave up 90 feet both time. Like, he also overran kind of a blooper that fell in front of him. He bunted, you know, popped up a bunt with a runner in scoring position, trying to take a chance. Like, he's not playing great baseball, or even like fundamentally sound baseball. And like, he's just kind of a fixture. And it reminded me like of, you know, when he batted for himself against Jose Alvarado in the ninth inning, representing a tying run against lefty, like batting for himself, first pitch ground out, like, Kevin Pillar's on the bench. He's theoretically like a better shot at, you know, tying the game. And it reminded me of 2012 in April when Robin Ventura pinch hit Adam Dunn for Alex Rios in the first month, and Rios actually got off to a good start. He was terrible in 2011, but in 2012, he got off to a decent start, but wasn't hitting for power. And then it was righty-righty, Dunn represented tying run, so he pinch hit with Dunn. And Rios was miffed after the game, and you know, I don't think Rios was lifted at any other point over the course of the season, because he actually was pretty good the rest of the year. But you know, early on, Rios hadn't proven himself to be invaluable to the White Sox, and there was a position to flex him out for a better bat or a more threatening bat for that specific situation. He did, and Rios grumbled about it after the game, but Ventura took the criticism, and you know, turned out that they had a nice enough year. I mean, they fell apart in September, but over the course of the year, like, Ventura was respected for his decision making and ultimately like pulling some levers that Guillen didn't or wouldn't or like refused to because of his interpersonal relationships or lack thereof with the front office. But like, he made tough calls. Sometimes like, he had to walk him back, like with Chris Sale, but like, he tried to make decisions that were his own. And ultimately, I think he earned some respect. And I think like with Grifol, like, maybe it's a case of like, Ventura, even though he's a first year manager, being a major league player, being a near Hall of Fame player, and saying like, you know, I've been around a clubhouse, I know what it's like, I'm going to do this. And like, Grifol, never having reached the big leagues as a player, and then also having a disaster of a year as a first year manager, I just wonder if there's like a fundamental, like, I can't afford to do anything that upsets anybody who could turn the clubhouse against me, because I have nothing else to lean back on. And so it's just all about like, you know, we know about his penchant for like, you know, brown nosing upwards, but there's probably an element of that too in the clubhouse, just not wanting to run afoul of players who could turn the tide against him. But yeah, I think if you go to like somebody like Charlie Montoyo, even if you don't expect to make huge difference in terms of wins and losses, I do think there are some levers that could be pulled that Grifol doesn't, he just simply refuses to pull just because of maybe like a fundamental insecurity of his own position.
I was going to ask, is this the end of Lenin Sosa with the White Sox being optioned? Because he's had three chances in 2024, 5-for-35 hitting before Sunday's game. In 2022, he was 4-for-35. So he has identical OPSs in 2024 and 2022 before Sunday's game. He performed better in 2023 with a 571 OPS. Like, he's young, Jim. He's only 24 years old. So if you cut ties with Lenin Sosa, I think another organization will pick him up and he'll be one of their middle infielders in AAA. But this has been three opportunities and Lenin Sosa's failed to impress. Is this it? Does he get a fourth shot with the White Sox?
You can never rule it out. when it comes to any player on the 40-man roster, like there have been a number of players who thought like, oh, it's the last we've seen him. Like even like Oscar Colas came back even just for a game, but you know, they made such a big show of, you know, Oscar Colas is going to be in AAA for as long as he possibly can. And then, you know, they still have to call him up, and we did technically see him, even if it's only for one plate appearance. But the White Sox being as starved as they are and injury plagued as they are, like you can't count anybody out. But I do think that this is probably his best opportunity to show something, even if it was just like fundamentally sound play and the occasional hit, their occasional extra base hit. But when he's still making the same mistakes that he made, both in the field that drew Grifols' ire and also just not hitting, you know, it's very possible like this is his best chance that is gone by the boards. And now it's just a matter of like he needs two or three breaks to go his way to come back. But if Danny Mendick, you know, comes up and like hits 240, and I know batting average is a very reductive stat, but with 8 of 9 White Sox in the lineup on Sunday batting under 200, and Martin Maldonado batting, you know, under 100, like I'm comfortable using like a 240 batting average as like just an easy reference point to like, that won't get you fired with the White Sox if you're providing that many hits that fall safely. So like if Danny Mendick does that, then yeah, I mean, that could be, you know, Sosa could be Wally Pipped the rest of the season, even though like Wally Pipped was actually okay. That's basically, you know, where he's at, I think, at this point in his career. And with the White Sox too, when they DFA guys, like they sometimes don't get claimed. So that's the other reason why I can't count them out. Yeah, it's bad. It's pretty bad situation for him. Like if he's the one being DFA'd with the way Braden Shoemake is playing. And I think it comes down to either one. And at least Shoemake made that cool over the shoulder catch that showed something, whereas Sosa has really just kind of been adrift.
Moving over to Garrett Crochet. Garrett Crochet, after having his worst start as a young professional, as a starting pitcher, losing 5-0 against the Cincinnati Reds because he had that one bad inning. The Philadelphia Phillies, Alec Baum, rude awakening for Garrett Crochet. He only went 3 innings. He allowed 5 hits, 3 home runs, allowed 7 earned runs, walked 2, only struck out 3 on 75 pitches against the Phillies. James, any reason to be concerned with Crochet's performance against the Phillies? Because it's been too... I don't want to say the Reds start was necessarily bad. He had one bad inning against the Reds, and he paid for it. Against the Phillies, watching the condensed game, not good at all. Like, just didn't seem ready to go against the Phillies, and the Phillies made him pay. Is there a reason concern, or is this just something that he could wash away and get ready to go to make his next start, which would be at home against the Rays?
I mean, it's concern. How often he's consistently commanding, that dictates his success as a starter. So like the more blips there are, the more it's an issue. And, you know, he didn't get burned on like bad pitches to Bohm. Neither one was like exactly just like groove fastball over the plate, but also his stuff is supposed to be such that he doesn't really get burned unless it's like a groove fastball over the plate. So like, it certainly wasn't a positive, but as far as like not seeing huge signs of like his velocity cratering, It kind of shows that this was going to be a chunkier, bumpier process than maybe his first couple starts really indicated. You know, I think his cutter works for him as a kind of mishmash of his two other pitches as something to blend in and give different looks. But I think there's going to be a little bit of league adjustment to it. I still think maybe his changeup needs to take something forward as something at least makes an appearance in his arsenal going forward. But I think he probably needs to be a bit finer or a bit more intentional with his breaking ball command to really get away over the course of 25, 30 starts. But I don't see this as like a huge red flag. This isn't going to work, but I think we got a little spoiled by the first couple of starts as far as like how smooth their processes would be.
Yeah, his first three starts, I mean, Crochet only allowed 4 earned runs against the Tigers, Royals, and Atlanta Braves. He's allowed 12 earned runs in his last 2 starts, spanning 7 2/3 innings. I misspoke. I was incorrect. Crochet will be making a start against the Minnesota Twins, so that'll be his next start, which we'll preview that series in a moment here with the podcast. And one thing I have to point out, when Crochet starts, Jim, it would be nice if the White Sox scored, In three of his five starts, the White Sox have been shut out. So we talked about this. Like, when can you pick the games that the White Sox are going to get shut out? Right now, you have really good odds on the Garrett Crochet starts, unfortunately, for him. And I wonder, for a young pitcher, I'll go back to you with this question, James. Do young pitchers ever talk about the benefits of having early run support, or are they able to just block out what their teammates are doing at the plate and just zero in on what they are trying to accomplish on the mound without looking at the scoreboard?
I mean, there's always like a positive statement of like, oh, it's nice to have good run support, you know, feeling confident, whatnot. There's not like, you know, the other side of it, which is like Grifol, I think, giving it public word that like, hey, all of our guys feel like they have to pitch a shutout, I think is enough fuel to say like, this is something that's putting pressure on them. Even if none of the young pitchers are coming out and saying like, I'm dying up there, I'm full of anxiety every pitch because of these jokesters can't score for me. There's not been like a ton of grousing about the offense. It's more about like trying to downplay it. But yeah, I think it's certainly an element of pressure that's not helping. I don't know if it's necessarily something that's being cited yet as this huge developmental hurdle they want to get by. I think they just don't want a downtrodden, miserable clubhouse that feels like there's no chance of winning. That's more the not great environment for pitching development than maybe individually moment to moment of impact of no run support.
Yeah, because it kind of reminds me back when Chris Sale was pitching like for the 2014 White Sox, Jim. Like, he knew he wasn't going to get run support in those starts, so he had to be amazing if he wanted to get wins, and he had very few decisions in that season, despite just how fantastic he was in 2014. And I'm wondering, Jim, if at some point, if Crochet's just got to have that type of mentality when you're pitching for a team that's this bad and you're trying to learn the craft of being a starting pitcher, that, you know, he's made some mistakes early in starts and then he can't overcome those mistakes and not get deep into the games. Like Aaron Nola, for example, gives up a 2-run homer in the first inning, but he's still able to go deep into that start, get back into rhythm, and shut down the White Sox offense. So maybe a start against the Minnesota Twins gets Crochet back on track. But are you concerned with anything that you've seen from Crochet in his past two starts against the Reds and Phillies?
I mean, if you kind of treat it as regressing to the mean, and like he's not going to be the White Sox automatic all-star, and there are going to be some bumps, and good offenses are the ones doing it to him, or at least, you know, deep offenses are the ones doing it to him. Like, yeah, I mean, that's not really a condemnation of what he's doing. And like thinking back to like Jose Quintana and John Danks, who are also like chronic under-supported guys, and like Danks, I think there's a lot of frustration, fan frustration around him, like not being good enough when, like, you know, he'd be clinging to a 2-1 lead and then give up a final run in his like sixth inning of work, and people would say like, oh, he's just five and dive or can't close games, and just, you know, there's a element of fatigue when like a pitcher isn't getting wins even if he's not doing it. I think now with pitchers getting paid regardless of how many games they're winning and getting Cy Young support, you know, because they're looking at the underlying peripherals versus like wins, losses, and maybe even like straight ERA in some cases, I think the pressure is probably off a little bit. I kind of think back to like James's characterization of Dylan Cease kind of floating through the clubhouse as everything's falling down around him, being like, well, I threw pretty well, or like, yeah, I'm holding mine to the bargain. Like, I think there is a little bit of a way to compartmentalize when it comes to pitchers not getting support. If, you know, you look at games and they're being outscored by an average of like 4.5 runs of 2 runs. It's like, well, 4.5 runs isn't bad for a team that's not supposed to be that good. You're not going to win 2 runs of support. So I'm still going to get paid next year is probably the mindset they take. And it's more about the position players realizing like, I may never get a major league contract again. I think that's probably the approach they have to take. But you may be like a guy like Michael Soroka, who's, you know, in that position of like, might be struggling to get his next job, Chris Flexen. I think those are guys who might feel the lack of like run support or just overall dread more than somebody like Crochet, who, you know, if this doesn't work out, can go to relief pretty easily and still have a lot of teams that are interested in the services.
Yeah, Michael Soroka, his ERA is now 7.5 after five starts against his start against the Phillies. He's got 15 walks and 12 strikeouts over 24 innings. So hopefully Gary Kirschick gets back on track and we'll see how he performs against the Minnesota Twins. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. We'll talk about that White Sox and Twins series, but also Jim Margulis went to Bowling Green to watch the Winston-Salem Dash, including Noah Schultz. So we'll get his report about Schultz, and James spoke to Jacob Gonzalez. So we'll talk a little White Sox prospects as well after a quick word from our sponsors on the Sox Machine podcast.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Sox Machine podcast. Before we preview the next series for the Chicago White Sox, let's try to talk some positive things that's going on with this organization. It's been a lot of dour for the first half of the show. And Jim, of course, everybody knows, lives in Nashville. He took the drive up north to Bowling Green, Kentucky, as the Winston-Salem Dash were visiting. And he got a chance to watch Noah Schultz, the top pitching prospect for the Chicago White Sox. And he wrote a little bit about Schultz on SoxMachine.com. You can read his recap. But Jim, how did Schultz look to you? Does he meet the hype? I mean, he's so young, but your recap suggests that he's not getting pushed in high A right now. It's not that much of a challenge. You kind of suggested that if you wanted to, you can bring him up to Birmingham and see if double A's a bigger challenge, but he's still also learning. Like, it's mixed after I read your recap. Like, I agree with you. Like, if he's not being challenged, send him to Birmingham. But I also agree with you. He still needs to learn how to be a starting pitcher and build up innings. So keep him in Winston-Salem. So after you got a chance to watch him, what do you think is the best direction for the White Sox handling Schultz?
I think he's fine in Winston-Salem right now. I think it's a case where he's his biggest threat. Like if he's in the strike zone, especially like against, lefties, if he's throwing a slider with any confidence, they have a really hard time seeing it. They have, even when they're thrown for strikes, even when like the location doesn't look that good, they're just not prepared to see that slider. And just a lot of swings and misses or weak foul balls or the sinker beat into the ground. It's really like when he walks guys, you can occasionally plunk a guy wild pitch because like sometimes his arm slot is tricky for catchers to catch. That bases can pile up on him a little bit and innings can get a little bit tangled. So, he's not, or I think Winston-Salem allows him to get up and down and accrue innings the way like going to Birmingham. Like if he gets smoked over 2 2/3 innings, like one, he gets beat up, and two, like he doesn't still throw as many pitches as he needs to in competition. He doesn't throw as many innings. He doesn't get used to like getting pushed to getting up and down 3, 4, 5 times every 5 days. So I think right now I would take the priority of getting him past his career high in innings, which is only 27 in a season. And once he's comfortably past that, I think then you can maybe push him to Birmingham, but he still like gets off kilter enough in a game to where there's stuff he can take away from a start. I think if it were more like his start against Asheville, where he strikes out 10 and 4 innings and gives up a couple hits, and every start looked like that, then you might think, well, he's not learning anything. This is the game on easy mode. He's never going to get better, and then maybe you have to push him. But I think right now, as long as he has these innings that kind of get away from him, then there's enough challenge to where you can prioritize just building up raw innings before you start thinking about like actually learning what hitters do to misplaced fastballs or hanging sliders or bad pitch sequences. I think that's still a little bit further down the road.
James, there used to be a saying called, there's no such thing as a pitching prospect. And with Schultz, he's so young. We talked about this before the season started, that if Schultz had gone to Vanderbilt, he would be a sophomore right now. And the Commodores could use Noah Schultz because they're in a tight race right now in the SEC. We would be watching Noah Schultz starting Fridays and Saturdays right now in Vanderbilt instead of high A with Winston-Salem. Are the White Sox treating Schultz like a prospect, in your opinion, or can they afford to treat him like a prospect at this moment and take their time, knowing that with pitchers at any moment, their elbow could blow up on them?
I don't think, the no such thing as a pitching prospect is boiled into, the attrition, how much like their stuff changes and backs up over time. I certainly don't think Noah Schultz would be the sort of person who gets you to undermine such a rule, given how risky and how much injury history there is and how difficult it is to necessarily project him in a straight line way going forward. I don't see how there's really any other option other than work him up slowly. I think if you pitched him heavy innings or were rushing him through, with the profile that he has, I get the idea that there's finite bullets in someone's arm, but just like there's so little experience there. I don't think there's really an option to fast track him. I think that would be looked up as like sheer wide-eyed mania by like the rest of the baseball industry. There's no real way to simulate like putting him into a lineup where he needs to use his third and fourth pitches more often, but without like getting through just some of the basic like hiccups of command and his delivery that like Jim's seen in a single inning. You can't really just like throw him and do that in the upper levels. He's just too raw. Like, it's very exciting. You see him kind of getting the stretches where he flattens the opposition that's the same age, like a bug. And he's like, why are we wasting time here? Let's get him up right away. But it's a really weird, wonky profile that I think it's kind of like, it's this stuff and the raw tools are better than Wolko, where I almost say like, just forget about him for a few years. But I wish you could, because it's just, we've never really seen projects like this work in the majors before. It's why you get the Randy Johnson comps, because there's just like no other reasonable successful model to follow. And I think being cautious with it is what you'll hear all the scouts say. I mean, you'll hear scouts complain about like Cannon and Nastrini starting right now because like they don't view the command as major league ready, or at least the stuff or the bat missing more for Cannon. I don't think Schultz would be the person you step on the gas with, just because it's so wonky and weird. It's not like this polished major league delivery and a fleshed out, already maxed out physical frame. It's this praying mantis playing baseball, and it's going to take some time.
Yeah, he's really tall. And you know that one by saying like 6'9", but like even in baseball context, where most players are above average heights, I was looking at the press box when I got in the ballpark, like seeing where he was, like, oh, it might be him. Like, that might be, that's definitely him. Like, once he stepped on the field, like, there's no mistaking him for anybody else. Especially like when he goes back in the dugout after an inning, just you're standing above, like, you have first baseman who's like foreheads come to his chin. Like, that's kind of like what you're looking at. So it's a build that even in the context of professional athletes is one that I think like a lot of coaches and trainers and such just aren't used to working with. And I think, given how tall he is, and you hear the knock, or not knock on tall, but the caution with tall pitchers is it can take them a long time for their mechanics to come in sync. Just like with the neurons firing, having longer to travel, it's harder for them to sync up all their limbs and get them on track. So the fact that he's able to throw strikes as well as he is, I think at this young of an age, is exciting and does, make it think it's possible to fast track. But I think just building him up and making sure that because of that weird frame and just the outlier, everything going on with him, that you make sure you respect still the sheer difficulty, making sure his mechanics are exactly what they need to be in order for him to be able to build the innings he needs to build.
I'm looking at Dylan Cease's baseball reference page because that's the last successful front-end starter the Chicago White Sox helped develop. And when the White Sox acquired Cease, he made 9 starts for Kannapolis back in 2017, covered 41 innings. I think Schultz is going to throw more than 41 innings. But in the following year, which was the age 22 season for Cease, he did stay in the minor leagues for the entire season, making 23 starts. He split time between Winston-Salem and Birmingham. So if Schultz stays with Winston-Salem all season, I could totally see that happening. Then 2025, he splits time between Winston-Salem and Birmingham. And then what are we looking at for an estimated time of arrival, Jim? Late 2026, is that realistic that we should be telling White Sox fans to expect Noah Schultz in the major leagues?
Well, I think if he's able to pitch like a full season in Winston-Salem this year, then I think he would start next year in Birmingham, because I think the hitters are just telling him nothing, really. As long as he is throwing the ball in the zone on a reliable basis and not creating his own problems. So if he's doing what he's been doing and he's able to survive the whole year and like pitch 70 to 80 innings or whichever target the White Sox want to get him to, then I think he'll start the year in Birmingham. Then I think it's just a matter of what the White Sox are playing for and whether his stuff can hold up once. Because right now he's even on an unusual schedule for a minor league pitcher. He's only pitching on Saturdays right now, so he still has to get to the every 5 days thing or the every 5.5 days thing and get to 100 innings. So I would say I would expect full seasons in the minors the next 2 years, unless there is some kind of like benefit to calling him up in September without like exhausting his rookie eligibility to like see how his stuff holds up, see what kind of opening day plans you might be able to make for him, assuming that they still will be some like form of buildup to go beyond that and some kind of, built-in rest periods built into a major league schedule. But I would assume rest of this year in Winston-Salem, if he gets up to Birmingham, like it, you know, maybe be like the last month or two. And then, you know, start next year in Birmingham.
Hey, if the Barons can win the first half, if they could get into the postseason, that'd be kind of fun for them to have Schultz for that, postseason run in the Southern League. That'd be cool. Cease did reach the majors at his age 23 season. Again, Schultz is only 20, so we're still maybe a couple years away. But your recap of him, Jim, watching the video, he's been very impressive. And I think he's going to reach the majors probably sooner than later. He may beat Cease and reach the majors at age 22, where, again, if he went into college, went to Vanderbilt, he wouldn't be draft eligible until next year. And then maybe he's pitching high A as a 22-year-old in the Chicago White Sox system if he was drafted by the White Sox. So Schultz is kind of following that same path as Colson Montgomery. Like, it's benefited these prep players to take the bonus money, skip college, and go directly into the minor leagues, a chance to reach the majors sooner than they would have if they had gone to college. On the flip side for the Winston-Salem Dash, they're really struggling offensively to start the season. But as a hyping this piece up that's coming on SoxMachine.com, James got a chance to sit down with last year's first-round pick, Jacob Gonzalez, a shortstop from Ole Miss. So far for Gonzalez in 14 games, he's hitting .220, but he does have a .371 on-base percentage. His slugging percentage is currently .360 as he has 4 extra base hits, but it is 11 walks to 6 strikeouts. And as an organization that's just thirsty for better on-base skills, for the ability to get on base no matter what, we'll get to the power in a moment. But after getting a chance to speak to Jacob Gonzalez, how's he feeling to the start of the season, James? Because last year was not a great first impression, but it was a very long year for Gonzalez.
Yeah, I think he's feeling better. He's very just like, you know, kind of iffy on his performance. I think he feels like there's a lot more in the tank, but he's pretty matter of fact about last season, you know, being bad. I think he even said that when he talked to media at the end of last season, that he didn't feel like he hit particularly well, but he wasn't very fazed by it. He thought like the way I played in spring, I was getting promoted, even though like it was a sub 600 OPS in low A last year. He kind of viewed it as like his assignment to go to low A last season was a little bit just like, just go play and we'll worry about adjustments later. And he spent the offseason kind of working on a tendency to pull off the ball, pull side that he was doing a lot, which made him vulnerable on the outer half of the plate. And now you're kind of seeing better at bats, though his strikeout to walk ratio was pretty good last year. It just like there wasn't any hard contact, and it's still kind of beef with what he's doing right now. I think he's maybe 1 for 12 since I spoke to him on the phone. So there's a pretty straight line, you know, to me ruining him and putting a promising season on the snide. But I thought talking to him is interesting. He's just very like, he views himself as kind of a contact hitter. I think he thinks about his strikeout to walk ratio and not swinging at bad pitches and his two strike approach more than he thinks about his power production. He views it as more like conditional and you know, just kind of a byproduct of what he's doing rather than something that like his game is geared around maximizing this standout tool. And he's very happy to tell you about how little he can do in batting practice. That's not to the pull side. So he's not someone who really sells out for power in any way. So I think it's obviously an intriguing package if he can tap into it at all, even if he's like a 15 home run guy and is someone who stays on the left side of the infield, which he doesn't really have natural shortstop tools or athleticism, but given how sound he's had to be defensively, at least fundamentally, to stick at shortstop as long as he's had, you see a lot of scouts projecting him to kind of move off the third base, which, you know, that then becomes the power a bit more issue to the play, but seeing at least some signs of him tapping into it early in the season, even if it's only just one home run so far. But the scouts I've talked to and from talking to him, he's added strength in a way that gives you optimism that he can be a bit more viable all across over the field than he was last season, while obviously a great, you know, starter kit in terms of his play discipline.
You can read that piece, the interview between James and Jacoby Gonzalez, again on SoxMachine.com early in the week. Back to the Chicago White Sox, unfortunately. They're heading to Minneapolis. Again, thank you to our Patreon supporters. James will be joining the White Sox in Minneapolis. The Minnesota Twins are 7-13 to start this season. And while some Twins fans are a little on edge, the number that scares them the most is that they're already 8 games back of the Cleveland Guardians in the American League Central standings. And they are currently in fourth place as Detroit and Kansas City also have winning records. And the Twins have not been playing great baseball. They have lost 7 of their last 10 games. And while we rag on the White Sox for their inability to hit with runners in scoring position, the Minnesota Twins are by far the worst team in baseball hitting with runners in scoring position. They have a team OPS of 461. So you're not exactly getting two juggernauts here coming and playing a 4-game series at Minneapolis at Target Field. And your pitching probables for this series on Monday night, 6:40 p.m. Central Time, starts for Tuesday and Wednesday as well. Jonathan Cannon will be making his second start against Chris Paddock, who's been struggling to start the season. Paddock has an 8.36 ERA. Eric Fetty will get the ball on Tuesday. He's got a tough test. Pablo Lopez will be making that start for the Twins. On Wednesday night, as I mentioned earlier, Garrett Crochet will be making the start against Joe Ryan, who's been throwing the ball well to start the season. And on Thursday, getaway day, 12:10, Michael Soroka against Bailey Ober. And James, for the White Sox here, they really could use some wins. I think Pedro Grifol needs some wins. The Twins are not playing good baseball, but focusing on Minnesota here, when does everyone start worrying about this start for the Minnesota Twins? Because there's a lot of red flags, and with how Cleveland has been playing to start this season and just the overall bad luck with all Minnesota sports, like, I'm worried here. If they split a series against the White Sox, I think you could have a lot of people start selling the Twins winning the AL Central in 2024.
It's April. They're fine. I don't know.
But, yeah, I remember saying that after about the White Sox.
I'd like to say it about like a normal team and have it actually like bear fruit, though. So something to justify not panicking, because I think that's a healthy habit long term. So if like a team could behave normally and just regress like we are they're supposed to, I would appreciate it for the sake of like my worldview. So I'm counting on the Twins, counting on Byron Buxton not being like the worst hitter in baseball by expected weighted bias on average among qualified hitters like he's been so far. I will kind of say like everyone treated Edouard Julien as like their saving grace, and like while he was running like a 30k rate, and now he's not like crazy by bipping, and the 30k rate's a bit more like hard to be like a super great on base guy with. So that part maybe is not as easy. They definitely got like a better than mean year from like Willy Castro last season, and now like they inserted him as the backup shortstop when Carlos Correa like gets hurt, and all of a sudden like, oh, that's not nearly as good. Maybe that part maybe is like a bit more foreseeable. And I would like to think there's some aggression, but like Carlos Santana is also 38, and maybe he's not the middle order like first base bat anymore. Like if that fell off a cliff randomly, like I don't know, it happened to Paul Konerko. Why is Carlos Santana too good to have that aging curve as well? So there's some like leaks in the boat that like may not be easily plugged and somewhat. And I could have probably some other organizations at least could have told them that maybe Chris Paddock wouldn't play as well as it looked out of the bullpen last season, or that Louis Varland is not as like a gimme just based on stuff models to be a plus starter as he maybe looked. So they maybe relied a little bit more on starting depth. They're really able to back up in the early moments, and maybe there's not as much offensive help coming in terms of their depth as I thought if everybody's going to be hurt, and Correa and Brooks Lee and Max Kepler are all going to be sidelined. That makes it a little bit harder. But I think generally there's a deep cast of players who they should be able to get more serviceable major league performances out of than the White Sox have. So I feel like they're going to be more fine, but they also, because their offense has been so putrid, like the White Sox need to win games 2-1. They probably have run into like the most obliging team to give them a couple 2-1 games over this week. And that would be obviously be very embarrassing for Minnesota, which is like a nice part of this team is that every time the White Sox win, you can like enjoy it on its own merits, but also enjoy by like the other fans, like freaking out, like, how do we let this happen? Oh my God, we lost the game to the White Sox. And I always thought that was a fun element of having a terrible team, of just the absolute mortification of the other side. Navy football fans must have just been enjoying that like their entire life, of every time they win a game, like the other team freaks out, we lost to a service academy. Why can't they figure out the option? They're just pitching it every time. Like, it'd be something like that. That kind of thrill for White Sox fans.
They're spinning the ball on their finger.
Yeah, exactly.
Byron Buxton so far sitting .217 with a .247 on base percentage, slugging just .333. Buxton has 0 home runs this season. He has 25 strikeouts, 1 walk. So Byron Buxton's going to hit 4 homers in this series, right, Jim? That's how this is going to go down. He's going to finally wake up.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Nick Castellanos was, you know, came into the Phillies series talking about like, is he going to be benched? Do they need to look for different options in right field? And he has a 3-hit game. You know, Kyle Schwarber, you know, can't stay off base against the White Sox. So on one hand, like the Twins could be the team that the White Sox, you know, catch while they're down and really fill them with existential dread. On the other hand, the White Sox could be the regression fodder for the Twins, saying like, well, you got to beat up on somebody. Let's start with, you know, having Byron Buxton hit a couple of like third level shots like he had against Liam Hendricks, and all of a sudden everybody feels better. So that's where the White Sox kind of are. When you're 3-18 is like, you have to kind of assume that they'll help other teams get on track versus they're going to be the ones being the penny on the railroad track that all of a sudden, one small, seemingly inconsequential object can throw everything off the rails. However, the one thing about the Twins, a couple things is, would be one, like 2016 isn't all that distant in terms of like the Twins having that random, how the hell is everything going this wrong season? And given, that they cut payroll despite winning the division and having attendance go up because of all of the uncertainty and following a very Rick Hahn-like strategy of investing in the bullpen when you could use a little bit more offensive depth or could use like more of a proven starting pitcher besides like Chris Paddock or somebody like that, that they could be, falling into a little bit of a hubris trap to where, a team like the Guardians or maybe teams that are, maybe not quite fully staffed yet, like the Tigers or Royals, but feisty enough to make teams question themselves in a series. The Twins could find it tougher than they thought in the way they had kind of a lazy offseason, maybe because they had to cut payroll, but just the way they conducted themselves in terms of player acquisition did make it seem like, yeah, we might be able to take this a little bit easy. And, you know, this might be catching up with them a little bit, given that the Guardians, I think, have a much longer history of overperforming what their rosters say they should be.
You have two of the worst offenses in the American League facing each other in this series. The Twins as a team are hitting 195 with a 281 on base percentage, slugging 329. That's a 610 OPS. The Chicago White Sox as a team are hitting 188 with a 264 on base percentage and slugging 288 as a team. My Lord. That's a 552 OPS. So yeah, two of the worst offenses in the American League. So James, I don't know what quality games you're going to be in attendance for this week. Like,
It's a living.
Like, do we go with the over-under again, Jim? 8.5 runs for the Twins and White Sox. Will either team score more than 8.5 runs in this series?
I thought you were going to say combined. I would say over a little bit.
You're going to say over?
I'm going to say over for the Twins, under for the White Sox.
In four games, not score 9 runs.
Oh, four games. Yeah, sorry. I was thinking like 3 games. The same math as the Philly series. So, yeah, I'll say over. But I'll say like maybe 10 runs feels like the over-under for the White Sox.
Well, again, the White Sox need some wins. If the Twins sweep the White Sox, then on our Thursday night podcast, as James is flying back home, then I'll go scorched earth and be like, okay, the White Sox are 3-22. You need to fire Pedro Grifol. Like, period.
I can only imagine the hijinks while I'm in the air. I
have all the hijinks in the air. and then we'll see in how it goes with the Tampa Bay Rays visiting. As the White Sox, after this 4-game series, wraps up their 7-game road trip to Philadelphia, Minnesota, the White Sox come back home for 3 games against the Rays and then 3 games against the Twins. And then you're the start of the May calendar, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. It's not going to be pretty for the White Sox. Let's stop talking about the White Sox. We'll end the show like we have been on Mondays, looking around Major League Baseball. What is catching our eye and our attention? Despite what James said last week, the Milwaukee Brewers are still red hot, James. This is totally sustainable, man. They're going to continue to be the second best offense. These guys are going to continue to still pitch. I'm kidding. But Jim, what's catching your eye when you're looking around Major League Baseball?
Astros still bad. Jose Abreu seeming like he might be having toast. To worry about his everyday, toast, but like right now, like immediately, more worried about like his everyday role, given that they do have some guys who can take his plate appearances either at first base or DH. So there's that, which is sad. Cardinals, they kind of baffled me in the offseason keeping Ollie Marmol, like seeing how bad everything went for them, and that, you know, kind of Mozeliak seems like his magic might be running out a little bit, that I thought they might want to have like a more convincing change of leadership, just because there were some, like, especially like the Wilson Contreras thing, that was one of those weird disconnects between the front office and management and player ranks, to be like, something's broken here. And, you know, now they've lost 4 in a row and nobody likes the way they look. So they're, you know, causing some panic that like last year was an aberration. So those two are jumping out. Otherwise, like, I'm surprised by the lack of like top end performances. Like the Orioles look like they're fully forming, and, you know, the Yankees are still pretty strong, but like the Dodgers, they've suffered some lumps pitching wise. So they're, you know, kind of drawn back to the middle of the NL West. The AL West, nobody's really breaking away there. So I'm kind of more drawn by the awful performances. Maybe that's because I'm used to watching with the White Sox, I'm more easily able to contextualize what bad looks like versus what good looks like, or good enough looks like. But that's kind of what's jumping out to me, is just kind of the severity of some of the bad performances.
How about you, James? What's catching your attention?
Well, I did go to Miami, not Miami. I went to the Wrigley Field Visitors Clubhouse this weekend, which is like Miami in many ways. So I talked to Tim Anderson while I was there. Skip Shoemaker, I interviewed him a little bit. I just sat on the manager's briefing and asked him about Tim. And, you know, he defended his work ethic and talked about how he's been good defensively, and he feels like he's been better defensively than the metrics would indicate. During this weekend, you know, Tim hit his first extra base hit since opening day, so there's a little bit signs of life at the bat, but Calling it up right now. His ground ball rate, you know, it's when his K rate is at like 31.6%, which is just like a level of swing and miss that he's never really had in his game. And I wonder about it, especially since he doesn't necessarily have the power or the pull side power that he had, you know, early in his career. His ground ball rate, you know, it went down. It was over 70 when I checked in it last. It's 67.4%.
Wow.
I don't think there's anyone who can really make a living that way. So, as much as like it's weird to see him in another uniform, it's, you know, sad to think about like what peak we were at with him and, you know, the energy he provided his franchise, you know, just less than three calendar years ago. There's just been a lot of leg injuries at this point, and now to like the level that he's not lifting the ball, I wonder what his 30s look like. It's early, he can snap out of it. You know, he dragged it down 4 percentage points since I last looked at it, but it's not the sort of start that makes you think like, man, this is being so much more interesting. They gave a bounce back. Like on one hand, like, yes, can Tim Anderson bounce back would be a more interesting like thing to like, this is what they're going to do at shortstop this year than like Paul DeJong hitting a bounce back, because I think there's probably a ceiling to where it can get. But they're also this responsibility of the team to kind of self-scout better than anyone. And, you know, at this point, it's looking like they probably made the right call and what he's able to do at this point in his career. That's more of like me genuinely answering the question. The main thing I wanted to say when you asked this is that I downloaded MLB The Show. I've never played a baseball video game, or at least not for 10 years. Never played MLB The Show before. And I have to say, the realism is stunning. I put down the White Sox as my team. They launched me into a game with the Texas Rangers. And in the first inning, I get a couple runners on. And then I swing too early with Eloy Jimenez. And I pop like the sky-high fly ball that like sails and barely clears the fence for a three-run wall scraper. I'm up on the Rangers. I am living the dream. We're never going to grow old. We're going to live forever. Like, everything's looking up. I lose this game 8-4. Stringing together hits is just an absolute grind throughout. Apologies to Andrew Vaughn. I had him swinging out of his shoes on sliders all day. I couldn't throw strikes with anything but my sinker, Derek Fetty. I could not get Corey Seager out to save my life. I brought in Tanner Banks to get me some length. And Fetty got into a jam in the fourth inning, and he was already up to 80 pitches. And it was like the perfect Tanner Banks thing where like the first pitch I threw was like a nuke and like scored two inherited runners. But then he settled down and he gave me two good innings. And I was like, I can work with this a little bit. But, you know, then giving up a solo shot to Corey Seager every time up was not sustainable. The only other run I scored for the rest of the game was Gavin Sheets pinch hitting for Martin Maldonado and just like swinging out of his shoes at the first pitch and hitting a solo shot. But everything else from there was like, unfortunately too real, except for the part where I didn't know the controls yet and I made Luis Robert dive after balls that were 30 feet over his head. That part wasn't that realistic. Everything else was like, this was a White Sox game. I hit a first inning home run, everything was changing, and then swinging at the first pitch all the time, five minute offensive innings. It was too real. It was not the escape from work that I envisioned.
In conclusion, Pedro Grifol is blameless.
It was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Like, the reason I downloaded the game is to play Road for Show and be a prospect who lives as chaotic evil and just makes the most like clubhouse murdering decision I can make at every point. I will launch into that as soon as possible. I don't want to play real White Sox games anymore.
Yeah, I've been trying to get traded from the White Sox because they moved me away from center field because Luis Robert was there, and then they traded Luis Robert and didn't move me back to center field. So I've been trying to get traded and they won't let me because my OPS is like 1500. I played for stress relief, not for realism.
We're going to have to check in now. This is going to be a thing on the podcast. Check it in and how James Fegan's MLB The Show campaign is going.
I want to put all my sliders on getting like an 80 fastball and having no command and killing people in the minor leagues.
And again, on Sox Machine, that will conclude for this episode. We'll recap all the games. Again, James Fegan will be in Minneapolis, so he'll be there to get interviews and reactions as the White Sox take on the Minnesota Twins. Chicago fans, I know what you guys are going to be paying attention to. It's all about Thursday night with the NFL draft, but I will also be releasing my first MLB mock draft as we are now past the halfway point in conference play. The college bats have gone super crazy, especially the top prospects. I've got film for Braden Montgomery of Texas A&M. All of a sudden, the Chicago White Sox have very intriguing options at pick number 5. So on Thursday, you could check that out, along with all of the NFL mock draft stuff, as the Chicago Bears have the number 1 and the 9th pick overall. I'll have my mock draft for you guys as well on Thursday on Sox Machine. Anything else to promote this week, Jim?
Well, I'm just looking into it, and Rice University's baseball program has a right-handed pitcher named Caleb Williams. I think now would be the time to issue a scouting report on him and whether the White Sox will draft him, just to confuse some Chicago Googlers.
That'll be my headline. Mock draft. Mock draft. Chicago takes Caleb Williams.
Should Chicago draft Caleb Williams? Question mark. Well, he's only a freshman at Rice right now. That is the answer. But yeah.
Oh, that'll draw some very angry traffic. There'll be some very angry comments. Like, what is this? Yes, we're playing with you guys. So, but anyways, yeah, look forward to all that talk later this week with the NFL. Of course, the Bears, big day for them on Thursday. And again, we'll have all the coverage of the Chicago White Sox this week on SoxMachine.com. But thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode. If you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch our videos on YouTube.com/SoxMachine. Thank you guys so much for doing that on that platform, especially with Google Podcasts being phased out. If you do listen to us and watch our videos on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button on our channel. It helps us greatly. You can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan, and you can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and help support James going out on the road and covering the Chicago White Sox team, sign up at patreon.com/SoxMachine. Monthly plans start at just $5. There's also an annual discount as well. Thank you to all those that were in the $2 and $3 Patreon tiers for upgrading to a current level of support. Continue to do that if you are on one of the older tiers that have been sunsetted. But for those that are new to Sox Machine, you can get full access to all of our coverage starting at just $5 a month. Sign up at patreon.com/SoxMachine. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.